The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello! And welcome to the Turning Point edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. I'm joined by Slate Moneybox columnist Jordan Weissman.
Hello.
And because Cathy O'Neill is on book tour, by popular demand, we feature the return of...
Hi, it's Lynette. Hi. I'm very excited to be here and to hear that I had a popular demand. Thank you.
Lynette Lopez. Ladies and gentlemen,
hi.
The senior finance correspondent at Business Insider, the host of... What's your podcast?
It's called Hard Pass.
It's called Hard Pass, and it's much shorter than Slate Money. So you can squeeze it in between episodes of Slate Money.
Right. Like, just in case you only want 6 minutes of me screaming in your ear, this is perfect for you. And the tagline is rejecting the business of everyday life. So you know there's going to be a lot of shade involved.
We are going to be talking about the big macro news of the week. I try and avoid macro, but this one you can't really avoid because there was this massive census report. And hey, guys, you're rich. Your wealth went up. You're amazing. Well done. Congratulations. Well done, you, for being so awesome and getting richer. We are also going to talk about a mega merger. There's a huge acquisition of Monsanto. You probably hate Monsanto. It seems to be the very sort of bien pensant thing to do is to hate Monsanto. They are being bought for like $56 billion by Bayer. But first, we are going to talk about Point.
This was the hot topic on econ and finance Twitter.
This was like, and I am not the best econ finance Twitter person, so you guys had to inform me that this was going on, and then I was like, this has gone too far for me to jump in right now.
There were like a lot of reasons, I think, that this blew up. But Felix, tell us what Point is.
So and then it all began, so Point has existed for a while, but of course no one noticed it because there have been a million different corporations and companies trying to do this kind of thing for a while, and they all fail, and it's no big deal. Until one day, Andreessen Horowitz comes along.
Dun, 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 dun.
And there's this weird, what do you call it, sort of knee-jerk ripple effect, which happens every time Andreessen Horowitz announces an investment in a new company, that suddenly everyone is talking about that company just by dint of an Andreessen Horowitz blog post.
Well, it's like the finance equivalent of if, like, Pharrell, like, says, hey, this artist is great. Like, all
of a
sudden,
it's like Kanye cussing at you or Rihanna giving you the side eye.
Exactly.
You are important.
So if Andreessen Horowitz says, yo, check this out, everyone says, okay, let's check this out. And then, so that's what basically
So then finance Twitter spent basically 2 or 3 days looking at the Andreessen Horowitz blog post, combing the points.com website, trying to work out what on earth is it preferred stock? Is it like a zero coupon loan with warrants
attached? Let's try and
explain it first of all in the terms which Andreessen Horowitz uses to explain it, which is basically you get to sell equity in your house.
Yeah. So instead of taking out a home equity loan, you can sell a share of your equity to Point. And then 10 years later, you pay them back what they gave you, or that you pay them back plus a percentage of, or sorry, 1, 2, 3. 10 years later, you pay them back a percentage of whatever your house appreciated. And that's where they make their money.
And so this is the first weird thing, is that normally when you sell equity, you get a bunch of money, and there's no obligation for you to pay back anything to anyone ever. Equity, by its nature, is a permanent thing, whereas this is not a permanent thing. This is a very finite thing. It ends after a 10-year, and after 10 years, you need to pay the money back. And not only do you need to pay the money back, you need to pay back the money plus a whole bunch of extra money according to how much your home has increased in value.
There's just a lot of ifs going on here. And when I read things like this, I'm like, okay, how are we going to get screwed doing this? Like, how? How? I mean, when Lou Ranieri created the mortgage bond, he didn't know that we were going to chop it up all nasty and fly it around the world. How are we going to chop this up nasty?
Well,
what's happening?
It's already chopped up nasty. One of the... So, okay, so there's this... two-sided market. Like, as the reason why Point looks like it might be a successful investment from the point of view of Andreessen Horowitz is that you have demand on both sides. On the one hand, you have people mostly trying to buy houses. And as we New Yorkers know, and as people in Silicon Valley know, and as other people know, buying houses are expensive, and
you don't
it costs
get
a lot
to buy
of money.
A house.
Well, so wait, I clarify this, and they're only doing current homeowners right now. They are not doing any home sales. I asked them about this because this was one of the things the Andreessen Horowitz post made it sound like they might be doing new purchases. And right now, that's not their goal at all.
Yeah,
it's only taking equity out of a house that you currently own.
And so that's one of the weird things because, you know, cash out refis, what could possibly go wrong? If anyone lived through the financial crisis.
Why does this keep happening?
But yeah, the idea of doing something with your house which puts a financial obligation on you, but you get a bunch of cash up front, the kind of people who take that offer weirdly tend to find themselves in sort of hot water down the road.
Yeah, so the reason this caught my...
But before we analyze it, let's just finish explaining what the hell this thing is first, because it's complicated.
Because I am still only 80% sure.
Well, so it's designed to... Like, let's take a $1 million house, and I'm not picking that just because it's a round number. I'm also picking that because it's what's known as super prime. The people who buy $1 million houses tend to be quite rich, and Point doesn't like taking credit risk, and it reckons that if it's essentially lending money to someone who can afford a $1 million house, and they're much more likely to get their money back after the end of 10 years.
Unless they're 50 cent.
So, unless they're 50 cents. So you have your $1 million house, and you sell 10% of it to Point for $100,000. So you get $100,000 in cash, minus like their 3% fee and all the rest of it. But you get $100,000 in cash. And then you don't need to pay any kind of interest payments on that $100,000. It's not a loan in that sense. If you sell your house, then 20% of the price appreciation of your house goes to Point, plus the original $100,000. So the example they give on their blog is that if you sell it for $1.2 million, then the appreciation is $200,000. 20% of that is $40,000. So you pay back $40,000 plus $100,000 is $140,000. What they don't do is say, well, like, what happens if it goes up to $2 million? In that case, 20% of the appreciation is $200,000. You have to pay back $300,000, which is three times the cash you got out.
So there's a flip side to this, too, which is that if your house loses value,
you still need to pay back $100,000.
Well, no. So Point actually takes some of the loss. They will take some if your house depreciates, Point will take some of those losses. Eventually,
but only after a certain amount.
What kind of degenerate gambler?
But then after that, if you, and I asked them about this, it seems like if your house goes totally underwater, their investment zeroes out. So they're not going to try and ring you for money if your house is 100% underwater.
That's kind.
You mean if the value of your house is zero?
If your equity is zero, essentially. Like, so if your first mortgage on the house is zero, is more than whatever equity you have left.
Right, because basically they're a second mortgage.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. So
They're a gussied up second mortgage.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't understand why anyone would want this.
Well, okay, so, all right, wait. Stop. Verlaine wants to say something.
Yeah.
Are they a bank? Like, this, I just need a word. Like, what are they?
Point is essentially a lender. They are essentially a mortgage company. They are lending money to you, but they're doing it on weird terms, which we're not used to yet.
Yeah. I do think that...
Or hopefully ever. Maybe never.
To give them, like, some credit as, like, why this might be socially useful, I do think the fact that they are willing to accept some losses in the case that your house declines in value, it does distinguish it somewhat from an ordinary loan because... Again, like the defining thing about debt is you pay the interest and you pay eventually the principal no matter what, or you're supposed to, or you default. Whereas this, they share some of the downside.
And the reason why this is a very bad way of implementing that is twofold.
Yeah.
Number one is simply that it's a second mortgage which gets layered on top of the main mortgage, which is the main obligation which people are worried about and which caused the financial crisis. And the way to fix this problem is to change mortgages and to do, like, you know, shed of appreciation mortgages or something like that, not to faff around with second mortgages.
Number two,
and this is equally important, the amount of downside that Point shares in is tiny. If your house goes down a little bit, you still need to pay them back everything you paid them. The only thing you don't have to do is pay them back any interest on top.
So I think, well, I mean, if it goes down enough, eventually you're not going to be paying back. But I think I will say I want to talk less about whether or not this is awful and a little bit about why I think there might be a market for it.
Well, the reason there's a market for it, and this is clearly, this is something which I've noticed a lot with a lot of these kind of bank replacement startups, which you find in California, is that they're coming from the demand side. That what they do is there's a bunch of hedge funds out there, and they're like, we want to invest in this, we want a way to get exposure to that. And there is definitely demand out there to get exposure to prime, expensive real estate.
Well,
it's not
also
something you can easily get exposure to if you're, say, a hedge fund. And this is a way of doing that.
I think there's some, they might also be zeroing in on a specific kind of consumer demand, which is there's this little known population in the U.S. that economists kind of call the paycheck to paycheck rich. It's essentially people who live in expensive suburbs, prime real estate area for the school district, but they can't quite afford, they don't have much liquid assets. They can't quite afford their lifestyle. Typically, their house is where all their wealth is stored, but they have a hard time going. They are essentially living month to month often. This is a way for people in that position who are a surprisingly large demographic and may not have great credit scores to get cash without having to worry about monthly payments. And it gives them 10 years during which their house can appreciate. Maybe their kids get out of high school. Who knows? That they can then, you know, just basically have some liquidity. So I can see who this might be developed for. And frankly, also, it's for people who just happen to have an expensive house and a low credit score. So maybe they moved there before it gentrified or something along those lines.
But the other thing that happens is that it's based on this idea. It's sold on this idea.
Yeah.
That if your house is doubled in value, you're not really going to mind paying back a lot more than you borrowed because your house has doubled in value and you just made $1 million. And in fact, come the day, it doesn't work like that because almost certainly any house which you're going to want to move into will have gone up in value as well. And you're going to want, you need to be on that property ladder with enough cash to be able to move into a new place. And the idea that you wind up having to pay this like really large check to essentially your second mortgage provider at exactly the same time that you're paying all of your brokerage fees to sell the old place and buy a new place and all the rest of it. That's actually when you need like the liquidity which you're losing.
Yeah. I mean, I can almost imagine, I can also just sort of imagine a situation where someone takes out a second regular mortgage to pay off their point
That's clearly the design.
Yeah. I mean,
is that like if you haven't sold your house after 10 years, the only way that you are realistically going to be able to pay point back, and by the way, they are the people telling you how much your house is worth, the only way that you can pay them back is by refinancing in some way.
Yeah. And this is the thing. If you two clowns can sit in here and come up with that stuff and all the downside of this, they definitely thought about it. But
it's true.
You don't think that Mark Andreessen has already thought this through? Or maybe he's just really high off the Kool-Aid? And he like really thinks this is great. I don't know.
That Mark Andreessen is also really high on Bitcoin Kool-Aid.
Oh yeah, okay, totally.
And there's this, and this is this whole thing, Silicon Valley, and he's also
annoying.
He also invested in Stripe. There's a bunch of Silicon Valley companies which have taken it upon themselves to decide that finance is broken and we are Silicon Valley and we can fix it.
I think they just hate bankers.
Wall
Street bankers.
Yeah. No, I mean, they definitely do see an opportunity. There is a sense there, I think, that, you know, banking is somehow broken and it needs to be disrupted. Sorry, I want to make the, I have the scare quotes
I
up.
Hate
but, and
that
so
word.
That they're going to look at stuff. It's just that sometimes the products that come up, they're going to come up with products that have their own downsides. Like every consumer product
seems like a lot of downsides, though, what you just talked about.
And they're going to look for, I think inherently, they're going to look for parts of the market that are not extremely well regulated. You know, so that's what you're going to find.
And this is also why so many of these Silicon Valley companies, like the student loan refinances, all the people trying to, like Affirm, who's trying to do other kind of like point-to-purchase lending, and these guys, they're all in some way or another doing in the lending business. And the reason is that, number one, there's a lot of spare money sloshing around, which people are happy to lend out for any kind of positive interest rate. Mm-hmm. And number two, lending by its nature is not particularly regulated, especially if you're doing it at sort of single-digit interest rates.
Unless it's a traditional mortgage, in which case you run into all sorts of things. So this is a way around that.
And if you're lending money to someone, you're providing them the money, and basically regulators are better than that, than if you're borrowing money from someone, which is what you're doing if you have a deposit account. There are very few fintech startups which take deposits. There are lots which will lend you money.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Let's go macro, Jordan.
All right. Fun time. I never get to go macro here.
Let's go macro.
It's sort of macro. So, yeah, you know, I don't want to oversell it, but some people were talking about how this week the Census Bureau released what may have been the best economic news of the decade, maybe. So one of the best economic reports of the decade. Every year they come out with this thing about income and poverty and health insurance in the U.S. And for a long time, middle class incomes have sort of just been stagnating. The key figure everyone looks for is like kind of median household income, right? Like what the absolute middle of the income distribution makes. This year, after all this post-recession stagnation, the median household income went up 5.2%. That's the fastest growth on record. It's since they started collecting this data in 1967. It is just, I mean, it's sort of a remarkable spurt after just waiting and waiting and waiting.
And it's a real result. It's not just some weird statistical glitch.
Yeah, so the reason why this...
That's a healthy...
We got some questions, yeah. I think, on Twitter that, you know, I think they were good questions, which is, how do you know this? We talk about random variability all the time on the show and in statistics. Like, how do we know this isn't just, like, you know, some glitch of the survey? And there's one of the reasons, I mean, A, you know, they have standard errors, things like that. But also, there's just like, there's a strong narrative for what happened here, which is we've last year, 2015, you know, unemployment was continued to drop. At the same time, we had this incredibly low inflation environment and wages picked up. The same, you also had minimum wage increases across a lot of the country, which, believe it or not, actually filter up to the middle class. There are a surprising amount of the middle wage workers are just like median, near the median in the income distribution. And so there are a lot of reasons to think something like this might have happened. It's just the strength of the results is, okay, finally, the middle class is recovering close to, or is, you know, it's the first time that we've seen any kind of an increase since 2007. And depending how you measure things, we were kind of almost getting around or slightly above or slightly below where we were, even in the late 90s, early 2000s.
So we're rich.
Yeah, no. I mean, I am a glass half empty kind of girl. And I just, we're still not where we were when Bill Clinton was president in the 90s.
Okay.
We're green.
So
but we have iPhones.
Yeah.
Ugh, whatever.
Well, so this is also, so my Moneybox predecessor, Matt Iglesias, has been harping on this question of, are we better off than where we were in the late 90s? And I think in some ways it's a little bit of a thicket. It's almost not worth getting into because you can literally change that result depending on what kind of inflation measure you use. And I don't think we're going to do a whole show devoted to the changed CPI index and the difference between.
I believe Matt Iglesias has already done that show. And if you want to go to the weeds, you can literally listen to it.
But I will say the headline here is that depending on which type of inflation measure you can do, it's like we're either 2% below where we were in 1999 or maybe 3% above. We're kind of in the same ballpark, though. And so I think, yeah, there is this active question is like we really need to focus on is like have living standards for the middle class gotten better or worse since that time kind of generally?
But I mean, there's two questions here, right?
Yeah.
One is like, are we at an all-time high for middle class living standards? And a lot of
certainly doesn't feel like it.
Depending on where you live and what color your skin is and various other things, like there are different answers to that question. There's another question, though, which I think is equally germane, which is, have middle-class living standards improved a lot over the past 12 months? And the answer is clearly yes, they have.
I think that you're starting to see, regardless, you're seeing, a turning point, is that the economic recovery that for so long didn't feel like it was filtering down to the middle class now is. You know, not just in the unemployment numbers, but in terms of like people's bank accounts, in terms of their earnings. And that's so important to just the way we kind of feel about ourselves, right, as a country, about the direction of things and people's positivity. And it just, things feed on themselves.
Universal, like it was every single income decile. It was like the 20th percentile, the 30th percentile, the 40th, the 60th, the 70th. It was white people, black people,
Do we have
Hispanic
to have the
people.
Why do we feel so crappy then talk?
Well, I mean, you feel crappy, Lynette, because you're a glass half empty kind of girl.
Well, I'm also wearing all black today.
I think
I don't feel crappy.
You don't feel crappy? I just feel so much angst as a millennial. You know, I'm worried about my social security. Am I even going to get it? All my brothers and sisters living in their parents' basement. When are they going to get out? Well, there's a lot of angst.
Right.
Still.
But that's the kind of angst which doesn't go away even with a 20% increase in money.
I think, though, you're right. There are ways in which, this is one measure, right? Like, it's median income. It doesn't tell you about everything, about, like, kids living in basements. I mean, that is a change since the late 2000s. You just have more people, like you said, millennials living in their parents' basements. That's almost like a secular change at this point. Just more young adults don't move out of their homes. And for a variety of reasons, we're still figuring out, a lot of which are just their sense of financial stability.
And also that changes this wonderful thing called household size.
Exactly.
If you're measuring household income and you have a minimum wage millennial as part of the household, then that makes the minimum wage income of that millennial only serves to provide an extra boost to the household income.
And then
we're all just sharing more.
Yeah, and there's
that's what it is.
I think
that's why we're getting rich.
To some extent, yeah. I mean, like you have to take that into account. You have to take into account, the variability in people's incomes. How do people are people being fired more often? Are they keeping their jobs longer? I mean, they're just are people. What are people's feelings about the future? Does it seem like in 1999, it seemed like there was sort of like an unlimited horizon. Now it still feels like we're recovering
from what
went wrong.
One of the great, I mean, there are time series for a lot of these things. And one of my favorite time series is this thing called the quit rate.
Yeah.
And it's a great indicator of optimism across the country rather than just among your friends.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is you measure how many people feel so confident in themselves and in the economy and in their ability to get a job that they feel free to just quit.
Oh, my God, never. That would never happen to me.
Yeah.
Well, the anxiety that I would feel.
I forget, what year did you graduate? I was 2008. So.
I was 2008, yeah.
Exactly. Oh, people who graduate that year are never going to be okay with that.
I'm never quitting a job. I've had the same job for 5 years.
Yeah.
And I'm a millennial. Quitting terrifies me.
Graduating into Lehman did that to a lot of people. But I forget where. I actually haven't looked
at the
quit
rate. But the quit rate has gone up.
Oh, so, yeah.
And what that means is that, for all that you, 2008 vintage millennials might have a lower quit rate than some of the rest of the population, even your quit rate is going up, statistically speaking,
among your cohort. Oh, we are starting to feel ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, so you can't take like one. I'm trying not to laugh at feel of ourselves. You can't take one.
I thought that was one of the phrases that made you feel squeamish.
No, I never mentioned that.
No,
but can I share something? I actually have a theory that I'm just going to put out there.
Yeah, sure.
I think that the divide between the young millennials and the old millennials, you can tell but one thing.
Yeah.
Patience for Kanye West. Speaking of feeling yourself,
yeah.
Old millennials, we don't do Kanye. We're
That's
tired
true.
Of his bullshit.
Oh, I still do Kanye.
Oh, get out of here.
Anyway,
Jordan.
So back anyway. Speaking of confidence. But wait, so yeah, I think the idea is like you can't look at one measure and say everything's great or everything's roses or not. But I think you're right. There is this kind of collection of indicators that we have that things really are moving in the right direction. You know, there's a lot of reason to think that these data were for 2015. There's a lot of reason to think that there will be a similar story in 2016, which is nice just because you've had the same kind of environment with extremely low inflation, wages still rising. So I think there's a sense that, yeah, we could have more good news next year.
I don't know, guys.
All right.
Lynette,
enough of your pessimism.
Sad.
We're going to move on to Lynette Lopez pessimism in a completely different arena.
We are.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Annette, what is the mega merger which you're pessimistic about this week?
I'm not pessimistic about it, though I'm not sure it's going to actually happen. When you have to get 30 different governments to agree on something, it's like, oh, well, we might as well not even try. But apparently Monsanto and Bayer are really, really jazzed about the idea of getting together and making the world seed daddy.
And they have... And they have a $2 billion breakup fee. If they don't get together, Bayer needs to pay Monsanto $2 billion.
Yes. That is a point.
So we could talk about like how I think when most people realize like what Bayer is, right? Because most people think Bayer or apparently
aspirin.
Yeah,
right.
They think aspirin. They think Bayer. It's apparently pronounced Bayer. Correctly in German, I just
whatever,
learned this.
Whatever, Germany. But
they've been saying that their executives have been saying Bayer in America so they don't make us feel dumb.
Like, so the thing which strikes me about this merger and the reason why I wanted to talk about it on Slate Money is that among, as I say, the a certain class of urban liberal, it is hard to come up with two companies which are more hated than Monsanto, on the one hand.
And any pharmaceutical company now.
Well, Monsanto in particular, because people have this obsession, irrational obsession, but obsession with genetically modified food, and they think that it's a horrible thing, and they don't want it. And they quite rightly associate Monsanto very closely with genetically modified
food.
Sure,
absolutely. Yeah.
Sure.
And then the other thing, of course, if you're a good urban liberal, is that you associate Bayer with... the company it used to be part of, which is called IG Farben, which created the Zyklon B gas, which killed all of the Jews in the Holocaust.
Well, I didn't know that.
I
don't think that's what the urban liberals are really hung up on
that,
these days.
And I'm an urban liberal. Yeah, wait. Let me talk about
it. That they produce now than it is Zyklon B. But
guys, what's really important here is that we don't know what this company is going to be called.
That's true.
And that is really fun. Like, what are we going to? Are we going to?
Well, it could be a rebranding.
Sea Jammers Incorporated.
Are they going to basically do away with the toxic name Monsanto?
Yeah, you've got to do away with that. Because this is like a big, scary company. And that's why it is going to require so much approval. And they're talking about potentially selling off assets for major commodities like soybeans, etc. Because like they got to bring this down.
One of my favorite like utter failures to communicate was in Davos one year. The Monsanto people were surprisingly talkative. Mostly the Monsanto people are not very talkative, and they don't do themselves any favors, by the way. They're constantly very defensive on the back foot. And they
shouldn't wear cloaks to meetings. That's also like a big tell.
I wore a cloak.
I'm kidding.
I was hanging out with Dan Barber, who is the chef at Blue Hill. And
Ooh,
who is a big like anti-Monsanto. He believes that you don't want monocultures and you want to have lots of tasty, locally grown food and this kind of thing. And he's kind of the opposite to what they think. But he is very rational and he doesn't scream at people. And it's possible to have a sensible debate with him. And so I spent most of the week just trying to sit down, either on or off the record, with the Monsanto person and Dan Barber, who was perfectly willing to do this, and just have a conversation. And it was impossible. And there's
so...
They would both talk to me individually, but Monsanto refused to be in the same room.
And isn't this just a metaphor for our world today?
Can I talk about the antitrust concerns? Because I want to.
Those are real.
Yeah, so here's what's interesting about this deal, is you have these, you know, Bayer, whatever you want to call it, is huge when it comes to pesticides. That's where they really have a stronghold in farming.
And although Monsanto makes Roundup, which is the other big one.
But that's not as big a part of Monsanto's business, which is really seeds. Like, we're talking about, you know, GMOs, you know, genetically modified seeds. And that's their strong suit. And so these two companies want to come together and create this farming biotech monster. The interesting thing about it is that they don't actually have that much in common in their businesses. So theoretically, it shouldn't pose that many obvious antitrust concerns. The thing is, people freaking out is just that you're creating a monster in the end. You're creating this giant company at the same time that other companies in this field are starting to merge. For instance, DuPont and Dow merged and spun off their seeds.
A lot of consolidation in the industry all around the world.
I want to jump in here and say that pesticides and seeds are two sides of exactly the same coin. The reason you buy a genetically modified seed, which is much, much, much more expensive than a normal seed, is there's only one reason why you do that. And that is because it works well with pesticides, basically. That you can spray a bunch of very effective pesticides all over your crops.
And
the seeds are genetically modified so that they just shrug and say, pesticide, pesticide, I'm going to grow.
We got it.
So if you have the same company making the pesticides and making the seeds, then that allows you to charge much more for the seeds, but because you wind up having to spend much less on, you know,
well, exactly. So that's
other kinds of farming. But the thing which has happened, and this is the reason why, the deep reason why there's so much consolidation in the industry, is that we are in a deep and long bear market when it comes to agricultural commodities.
Oh, yeah.
Things like soybeans and corn are at multi-decade lows. And so people are much less inclined to pay through the nose for genetically modified seeds anymore because they're just not making money.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, according to the deal, they're going to save about $1.5 billion over the next 3 years on synergies and all that stuff that bankers love to talk about with their charts and stuff. And, you know, this is a great deal for the bankers. They're going to make hundreds of millions of dollars, including this, like, small boutique bank that somehow made it onto the deal. Way to go, guys. Way to do it upright. And what's also impressive is this is an all-cash deal. Like, when do we see that on Wall Street?
Well, when you have extremely low interest rates and companies can't think of anything that you want to invest in.
All cash means...
Yeah, borrowed money.
Big syndicated loans.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I think, you know, you can...
Syndicated loans.
Oh, yeah. This is going to be like, we're going to have AB loans. We're going to have bonds. There's going to be so much Bayer debt out there, you have no idea. God.
Which, I mean, given that companies in Germany right now are basically borrowing for nothing or less than nothing is not... You know, I mean, I don't know if Bayer's on the list of German companies that are selling negative yields on their bonds, selling bonds at negative yields, but there are German companies that are putting out bonds.
Which I'm just going to totally change the subject here and mention that the Bank of England, as part of its QE, is not just buying gilts, you know, British government debt. It's also buying bonds issued by corporations. Among those corporations are Apple and Verizon. And Apple and Verizon are now basically selling bonds straight to the Bank of England.
Jesus. This is going to get so weird.
I mean, the thing is, like, corporations can borrow. So, actually, this is direct to Leo, which is corporations can borrow for almost nothing at this point. Major corporations, big conglomerates especially. And What do they do? You know, the idea is that hopefully they're going to take that and invest. But these companies like Bayer are saying, eh, we're not going to invest. We're just going to use this to do giant mergers. And so, you know, this is actually kind of a result of our monetary policy in some ways, too. And it kind of shows why our monetary policies around the world don't always work the way it's intended.
No, and that's one of the – this is goes back to what I said earlier. It's like how – what is the unintended consequence of this? Can we look a few, you know, years down the road and think the most awful thing that could possibly happen from this?
Well – I can't, but I do.
Because that's what I like.
Well, I feel like it's like, you know, it's Godzilla. But
yeah.
but I think Jordan has a really good point. The thing which is genuinely tying all three of our disparate segments together is monetary policy and like just this these oceans of cash which are sloshing around the world. They're looking for somewhere to go. So they go into, you know, they go into Andreessen Horowitz. Then they get invested into Point. Point wants to find a place to invest cash in an alternate asset class, which is housing. Bayer needs a reason to borrow billions of dollars because it can do it for free. And even some of it, finally, a little bit is trickling
down
into the pockets of the middle class.
That's a way to tie all this together.
Good for you, Felix.
I want to just put a, kind of a coda on the Bayer Monsanto merger, though, and your skepticism about whether or not it'll happen. The main reason why I think this deal is going to have a really hard time coming to fruition isn't even the Justice Department, which has been pretty skeptical about big mega mergers lately. It's the guy who runs the Judiciary Committee in the Senate. That is Chuck Grassley.
Oh,
Chuck
yes.
Grassley is an ornery old senator.
Is he Kansas or Nebraska?
Iowa.
Iowa?
He cares a lot about farmers. And he is a very smart, very aggressive guy who, if he thinks that this merger is going to create problems for his constituents, who are basically farmers, he is going to make hell. He is going to make a lot of noise. And already you're seeing guys like Mike Lee from Utah also sound off on this. I don't know. I mean, technically, the Senate isn't supposed to be able to stop these kinds of things, but they can really ramp up political pressure. And I wouldn't, and also create space for the Justice Department to say, fuck no.
And this is just such a sexy thing for people to hate. Like, yeah. This is just too easy. It's like...
It's really hard to find anyone who's going to come out and say, yay, Bayer and Monsanto are merging. What a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, you would hope the one group that you think is maybe Senate Republicans would be in favor, but obviously because of what it touches on already, they're kind of coming out. So it's...
They are so busy right now anyway.
Yeah. Anyway.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
And finally, we have a numbers round, as ever.
We've stumbled our way to it.
We've stumbled our way into the numbers round.
I messed up the numbers round again, guys.
What did you...
I brought a number. You're just not going to like where it's from.
Okay, what...
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Is it involving He Who Shall Not Be Named?
He Who Shall Not Be Named.
Can we just refer
involved.
To He Who...
Okay, so Jordan's going to do his number. I'm going to do my number. And then you're going to come up with a number which does not involve Voldemort.
Okay, fine. I'll do it. I'm going to find it.
Okay. So my number is a little bit of a downer from that census report we were talking about before. It was sort of hidden. My number is 3.5. And that's the percentage of Americans who were pushed into poverty by medical expenses last year. And that's according to a sort of alternative measure called the supplemental poverty measure that takes into account things like also your post-tax and transfer income, yada, yada, and certain expenses. But the main thing to remember is about 3.5% of Americans who are pushed into poverty because of things like doctor's co-pays, drug costs, et cetera. What's a little bit disturbing to me about this number is that it hasn't really been getting better in the Obamacare era. If you look back to a few years back before, like 2013, 2012, it's about the same. It's not budging. So even though more people are getting insured and they're getting on things like Medicaid, you still have this population that is getting literally pushed into impoverishment because of their health. And I don't know if Obamacare is not fixing that. I don't know what will at this point. It's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit disturbing to me.
I think one thing that's really interesting about what your point saying is that deductibles have gotten really, really high.
They have, yeah.
Under Obamacare. And I think that that has really exacerbated this problem.
Yes, no, absolutely. High deductible plans are probably one of the things. Although, you know, so a lot of these people are sort of going to be on Medicaid.
Lightning round.
All right. Lightning round. I'm giving her time to come up with something that's not Voldemort.
I have one now.
Okay. What's your number?
It's $2.69, which is how much it costs to get a Burger King. The new mac and Cheetos, or no, these are Cheeto chicken fries, which our good intrepid reporter Hollis Johnson wrote about with lots of pictures. These cartons look like Angry Birds.
Wait, so this is
and they
fries?
Go in your mouth,
but they're made with
they're
Cheetos.
Chicken fries and they're dusted.
Wait, what is a chicken fry? I don't understand any of these words.
Stop. I can't hear myself think over your Britishness. Okay. So it is they've been called dangerously cheesy.
What's it made of?
It's a chicken. It's a piece of chicken shaped like a French fry that's been fried in Cheeto dust, basically.
Okay, yeah.
Look on Felix's face.
The expression on Felix's face, you're just gonna have to imagine. Okay, $2.69
$2.69, but think of how high deductibles are right now, guys.
And also, for the record, because this is Slate money, we do need to mention that, according to Jordan Weissman, McDonald's is one of the greatest things that has happened to American capitalism
I never said Burger King was.
Oh, wait, is that Burger King?
That's Burger King.
That's Burger King.
McDonald's, not Burger King.
All right, okay. My number is 3. While the economic data people were cavilling over the census data, the Academy, all of the economists out there, were really only talking about one thing, which was this paper which Paul Romer wrote called The Trouble with Macroeconomics.
Yeah.
And I can highly recommend, if you like reading, fun economics polemics.
Oh, my God.
There are not very many of them, and this is a good one. Mm-hmm. And 3 is, quote, the number of decades of intellectual regress that he says that he has seen in the macroeconomic world. And he basically...
He basically takes
the entire macroeconomic world, every single macroeconomist out there, and says, you are talking complete and utter bullshit. And it came out just after Narayana Kocherlakota, who's Slate Money's official favorite macroeconomist...
Good to know.
Said something very similar. He had a piece called The Puzzling Prevalence of Puzzles, where he said something very similar. And so we are finally seeing a backlash against the economists. And there was this famous question from the Queen of England when she came up to a bunch of economists. And she said, why did none of you see this happening? And now finally the economists are going, yeah, we have no idea.
Can we please have an episode where we just talk about DSGE models?
No.
Please,
no.
Shut up.
Okay.
But I think we have now officially reached the point at which there is a kind of consensus, a weird consensus among what you might call meta-economists, the people who think about economics as a profession, that DSGE models and all of these other things that happen in universities are completely useless when it comes to actually describing planet Earth.
One day we will try to have an episode where we talk we will have an episode where we talk about what real business cycle theory actually says, and you're going to think we're smoking weed.
This is not an economics podcast.
You're going to have to
have your own podcast, Jordan, for that one. Or maybe you can join Matt Iglesias on the weeds and talk about it.
I'll put in a request. Anyway.
Okay. That is it.
That's sad
for us this week. Thank you for listening to Slate Money. Do leave us reviews on the iTunes store if you can. Send us an email. Our email address, as ever, is slatemoney@slate.com. Many thanks to Vera Lynn Williams, who produced, and to the executive producers, Steve Lichtai and Andy Bowers. Many, many particular thanks to Lynette Lopez for coming on and doing her awesome Lynette-ness.
Thank you.
And go check out all of the rest of the Panoply podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. And the subset, there's a particular subset of Panoply podcasts which includes Slate Money, which are the Slate podcasts, and they are all free, ad-free, if you listen to Slate Plus, if you subscribe to Slate Plus. So for Slate's 20th anniversary, you can get 30% off an annual membership. That's $35 for a year of Slate Plus. You get to listen to Slate Money without having to listen to me talk about beds and mattresses and things, if you feel like that's an advantage. On the other hand, keep on listening to Slate Money. Do subscribe to us and enjoy the ads if you like them. We'll talk to you next week on Slate Money.